fourscore and suing seven women ago, says Donald Trump in Gettysburg. And lest we forget, all campaigns are created equal on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The polls no longer say who is winning, but now it's by how much. What will these final 2 weeks look like?
It really is way too late in the campaign, though, for any one particular development, either in the economy or the political or world, to change things dramatically. Though, I don't know, knock on wood, all kinds of awful things could happen, and who knows how it would affect the campaign.
Republicans are running away from Trump in their hopes of maintaining control of the Senate. How vulnerable is Missouri incumbent Roy Blunt?
We'll see. Roy Blunt's been around Missouri for decades now, has been a steady eddy kind of presence inside the Republican Party, has found a way to navigate between the moderate and the more conservative factions.
And we'll revisit my 2015 conversation with Tom Hayden, the Chicago 7 radical turned social advocate who died this week.
We never got permits for any of our marches, and you started to get bedlam in the streets because people tried to march anyway, but police would beat them and gas them and drag us away to Cook County Jail.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 151 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. No more pencils, no more books, no more debates, and no more candidates' dirty looks at each other. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are in the final stretch of the 2016 presidential campaign, a race that seemed nip and tuck for much of the fall until now. The polls, the most recent being the ABC News Washington Post survey, seem to indicate a growing Clinton lead. And with that lead, Clinton says she no longer needs to respond to what Trump has to say. Instead, she's been urging voters to vote for Democrats up and down the ticket. In Pennsylvania, not only did she push the Senate candidacy of Katie McGinty, but she went after Republican incumbent Pat Toomey for not distancing himself from Trump.
I think it's pretty clear when you look at Katie's opponent. He still refuses to stand up to Donald Trump. Now, you know, a lot of Republicans have. They have had the grit and the guts to stand up and say, he does not represent me. But Pat Toomey heard Donald attack a grieving Gold Star family who lost their son in Iraq. He heard Donald call Mexican immigrants rapists. He heard him say terrible things about women. He heard him spread the lie that our first black president wasn't really born in America. Now, how much more does Pat Toomey need to hear?
Clinton has done the same in North Carolina, New Hampshire, and other states where control of the Senate is paramount. And she's not the only one taking the fight to Republicans. Here's President Obama campaigning for her in Florida. This part came after he praised Democratic Senate candidate Patrick Murphy.
You want me to say it again? He said, Marco Rubio said, this was a dangerous con artist who spent a career sticking it to working people. Now, that begs the question, since we're in Florida, why does Marco Rubio still plan to vote for Donald Trump? Why is he supporting Donald Trump? How can you call him a con artist and dangerous and object to all the controversial things he says? And then say, but I'm still going to vote for him. Come on, man.
If the Democrats seem energized, the same cannot be said about the GOP. It's not been a good couple of weeks for Trump, not after the second and third debates, not after the release of that infamous tape where he talks about groping women. I mean, who gets booed at the Al Smith charity dinner in New York? Donald Trump did.
Hillary is so corrupt. She got kicked off the Watergate Commission. How corrupt do you have to be to get kicked off the Watergate Commission? Pretty corrupt. We've learned so much from WikiLeaks. For example, Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics.
And then, after promising to make the case for his candidacy at a rally in Gettysburg, Trump instead spent a good portion of the speech talking about a rigged election and the women who have come forward accusing him of sexual misconduct.
The system is also rigged because Hillary Clinton should have been precluded from running for the presidency of the United States. But the FBI and the Justice Department covered up her crimes, which included lying to the FBI and Congress on numerous occasions, and included saying, I do not recall, to the FBI on 39 separate times. She recalls everything else, but 39 separate times she said, I do not recall. Well, that's a lie also. Every woman lied when they came forward to hurt my campaign. Total fabrication. The events never happened, never. All of these liars will be sued after the election is over.
Trump is not alone with his complaints about the election being rigged. An NBC News Survey Monkey poll shows that 45% of Republicans would not accept the election results if their candidate lost. By comparison, 82% of Democrats said they would accept the results. I think that lets you know who's winning. Here's a little Electoral College trivia question for you this week. Who was the first presidential candidate to win New York and California and still go on to lose the election? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. It almost feels like, with the debates having come and gone, there's nothing left but the shouting. Not true. With early voting already underway, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are still hitting the campaign trail, urging their supporters to make sure they get out and vote. Hovering all of this are a series of questions. What will be the effect on down-ticket races? Can the Democrats win both the Senate and the House? Will Trump accept the results if he loses? And wither the Republican Party? Fear not, we have Janet Hook to take on those questions. Janet is the national political reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she's been traveling as much as the candidates have. Janet, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks so much for having me again.
It seems like, I don't know about you, it just feels like there's a different mood out there now that the debates are over. Do you sense a little change there?
Well, it does take away the sense of looking ahead to some event like a debate that can be a real pivot point that you know will be a big testing time for both the candidates. Right now, there's no certain thing that's going to happen between now and the actual voting. So in a way, it puts more suspense on how every single day goes. Like, does Donald Trump say something crazy? Does Hillary Clinton, you know, come down with some new illness? You know, it was funny when you were saying it's all over, but the shouting, you know, with this campaign, it's they're going to be shouting all the way.
Exactly. And I was just thinking, were you saying that we no longer have debates to look forward to, as if we were looking forward to those debates?
Okay, see, look ahead to. You know.
With a few exceptions, I noticed in the national polls, and of course, it's not a national election, it's individual states, but with a few exceptions, I see Hillary Clinton with a sizable lead, anywhere between 8 and 12 points. Is that your sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the polls coming out show. I mean, there are a few outliers that show Trump with a small lead, and he always makes a point of pointing to those and then saying all the rest of them are phony. But that's one of the services that Real Clear Politics does for us, is it compiles all the polls as they come out and then gives you kind of a rolling average. So it kind of helps to stabilize the kind of roller coaster of looking at every single poll. And as of right now in the four-way race, it averages out to a lead for Clinton of almost 5 points.
Now that Hillary Clinton is saying that I'm no longer going to respond to everything Donald Trump says or anything that Donald Trump says, and I'm going to work instead on bringing more Democrats with me in the House and Senate, it sounds like, not that she's overconfident, but she's certainly planning ahead for getting as many allies with her once she comes into office.
Right. And I do think also it's smart strategy for her at this moment to kind of try to rise above it all. Because voters don't particularly like all of this negativity and the candidates attacking each other. I mean, she had to do a fair amount of that in the run-up to this last stage of the campaign. And, you know, attacking Donald Trump has been a staple of her campaign. But it really does set a different tone for her to say, okay, so enough with what we're all against. Let me tell you what I'm for. And also to have this, I mean, she's been posing the campaign question in a very high-minded way. In almost everything she says, at some point she raises the question, what kind of a country do we want to be? I mean, that's different from vote for me because I will do X. She's kind of raising it as a moral question that she thinks will reflect badly on Donald Trump.
And while the news, at least in the polls, look good for her, you talk about what Hillary Clinton's vision might be and how she sees it. Recent articles in the papers around the country show that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, among other progressives around the country, may have their own vision.
Sure, yeah. You can actually see everybody kind of looking ahead to after the election and thinking about, okay, now that we can kind of take it for granted that she's going to be president, what are we thinking about? And the liberals really want to make sure that she doesn't give up on their agenda now that she's just about to get their votes. And so there's a sense of the emerging battle within the Democratic Party on how to govern.
There's also on the Donald Trump campaign, you know, I mean, if he only has, now it's less than 2 weeks to make his case, to do his final argument why he brings the change that Hillary Clinton doesn't bring. What do you think of these strategies about going to an Al Smith? We played the tape earlier in the program. He goes to Al Smith and gets booed. I mean, who gets booed at a charity dinner? And then if he's doing his speech in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where a good portion of it, he talks about suing the women who's accused him of sexual impropriety. That's a very strange, to me, a strange way of making the final case to his candidacy.
Well, frankly, I don't think either of those events, the Al Smith dinner or the mention of the women at Gettysburg, were strategies. They were mistakes. And I don't think they thought this is a smart thing to do. It's just kind of the Al Smith dinner. He clearly had misjudged the audience and wrote a speech that was a tone that I don't think there was any way in which that was intended to go over that way. And then in Gettysburg, you know, in truth, there really was just one or two lines about the women who'd accused him of sexual misconduct and him threatening to sue. But the fact is, the whole rest of the speech was kind of laying out his agenda for governing the first 100 days, and it was kind of very familiar stuff. There was no news in it. There were like two new things in them, and one of them was him threatening to sue. So it wasn't the bulk of the speech, but it was the line that kind of eclipsed the rest of the speech.
Do you think there's anything he could do in the final 10, 11 days that he could help his party or help his cause? I know, of course, the headlines in the papers this week is all about the rising Affordable Care Act premiums, which one would think would be a great issue for Donald Trump. But he doesn't seem to be capitalizing on that either.
Right. That's a potentially very damaging development for the Democrats, I mean, part of the thing is that Trump really has been talking about that and forecasting these premium increases for a long time. So even for him, it's kind of not a new issue. He might have been he might be more aggressive in framing it. It does kind of amount to preaching to the converted, though. Whenever you're at his rallies, he always gets to the line about repealing and replacing Obamacare. And it's almost like the rhetorical flourish obscures like the real pocketbook issue, which is that the premiums are going up and that availability is getting more limited. It really is way too late in the campaign, though, for any one particular development, either in the economy or the political or world scene, to change things dramatically. Though, I don't know, knock on wood, all kinds of awful things could happen, and who knows how it would affect the campaign. But right now, even when he gets a development like that in the news favorable to him, you're right, he doesn't seem to be able to capitalize on it to expand his base. I mean, certainly it's a message that his base is receptive to hearing.
Looking at the polls, and if you study the history of polling, I don't believe any presidential candidate, at least in the recent history of polling, has ever come back from such a large deficit. I mean, maybe the average is 5 or 6 points. The ABC Washington Post poll had it at 12. Whatever the number is, I don't think anybody's ever come back from that and won the election in the end. Maybe Ronald Reagan in 1980, but I don't even know if he was that far back. But the question is also, if that's the case, then basically the battle now is control of the Senate, and we all know that the Democrats need a net gain of 4 if Hillary Clinton is elected. How do you see the battle for the Senate right now?
Right. Well, that is kind of where both parties are focusing a lot of their attention now, especially the Republicans turning their energy and their money to trying to protect the vulnerable incumbent senators. And they've been doing it for quite some time, but I think that the sense of urgency has increased and the amount of money pouring into those races has also. And I do think that, to a large extent, the Senate Republican incumbents have done a pretty good job of trying to distinguish themselves from Trump, but you really can't totally distance yourself from the effect of the top of the ticket going down if he goes down in flames. And so, you know, you've got a senator like Kelly Ayotte, who has just been on a roller coaster with Donald Trump. She's consistently running ahead of him, but as he sinks, she sinks as well. Same thing with Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania.
Maybe Marco Rubio, maybe?
Right. Well, Marco Rubio's been running stronger in the polls lately. He and Rob Portman may have a little bit more independent lift. Rob Portman's been running a very powerful campaign in Ohio against a Democratic candidate, Ted Strickland, who hasn't been running such a good campaign. You know, that's probably the moment of greatest suspense in my mind on election night is whether the Republicans manage to hold on. I think that winning the House is still a real long shot for the Democrats.
I would say when you mentioned Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, of course, her distancing herself from Donald Trump could provoke the ire of all these Trump voters who say, well, you separate from him, we'll separate from you.
Right. So I think in the end, she probably calculated that her last move. I mean, the fact is Kelly has taken so many different positions on Donald Trump that somebody can always find something to dislike. I didn't like her when she did this, supported him when she opposed him, when she supported him. The last flip was after the videotape came out, the Access Hollywood videotape of him speaking so lewdly about women. And she said, I can't support him. I'm going to write in Mike Pence. I think the people she might have alienated with that, they're not going to go vote for her Democratic opponent. I mean, they might not vote for her, but I don't think she's going to lose a lot of votes to the Democratic side by saying that.
Right, because before that tape came out, everything was fine with Donald Trump said about women.
Right, right.
Do you see that all of this ending on November 8th? I mean, with Donald Trump threatening not to accept the results, somehow I think that November 8th is almost an artificial end to this, and it doesn't end then.
Well, it depends. I mean, if it's a decisive victory, if it's, you know, kind of a big margin, he'll have a really hard time contesting the results. I mean, even if there's one close state, if the Electoral College math is pretty clear, it's really going to be hard for him to kick up any kind of legal fuss. I mean, he may continue as a political force, and I mean, that's the big question for me is if Donald Trump loses, what does he do next? Does he retreat to Trump Tower and go back to being a businessman, or does he see himself as a leader of an opposition political movement? Because he could stir up a lot of trouble if he's, you know, heckling from the sidelines every time Hillary Clinton does something. It may be that he won't get as much attention, but he can make a lot of trouble.
And not only can he make trouble for Hillary Clinton, he could also make trouble for Paul Ryan. I guess the final question is, whither the GOP after all of this?
Yeah, boy. lot of people thinking about that because, I mean, basically, Trump has either remade or destroyed the Republican Party for now. And then what do they do afterwards if he isn't president? Which wing of the party dominates? Does the old wing dominate? Does the old wing say, does the establishment say, well, I guess we got some things wrong. We've got to learn some lessons from Trump? Or do they just conclude Trump was some big, fat historical mistake and try to restore the status quo? You know, they've got a lot of soul searching to do after this.
Remember all those postmortems after 2012, all the lessons Republicans supposedly learned after Mitt Romney lost, and they didn't seem to learn those lessons too well, did they?
Right, right. I mean, they could go back to that autopsy that they wrote up, but I think they're going to have to do a whole... Because I do think that both parties have a lot to learn from the voices of the voters that came out and supported Donald Trump. They spoke in large numbers and they spoke loudly. And they can't be ignored. They may not be a majority, but there's sort of a force in the American electorate that was not in such clear focus before. And it may have lessons for both parties.
I guess so, the people who came on board for Donald Trump and the people who came on board for Bernie Sanders.
That's right. I mean, there was a large faction in both parties that wasn't happy with the leadership and the establishment. And Bernie Sanders gave Hillary Clinton more of a run for her money than anybody expected. And Lord knows we all underestimated Donald Trump's staying power.
Janet Hook is a national political reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Janet, I know you don't have a debate to look forward to anymore, but there is November 8th coming around the corner.
That's right. Thank you so much, Ken.
Janet, thank you. If the presidential race is all but decided, and that's still debatable, the battle for the Senate is still in high gear. As everyone knows, if Clinton wins the White House, then the Democrats need a net gain of 4 seats to gain control of the Senate. Not that anyone can control the Senate. This week, we're going to look at 2 races, in Nevada, which is perhaps the Republicans' only chance at a pickup, and Missouri, where the Democratic challenger has turned the race into a surprisingly close contest. We'll start with Nevada. It's a seat Harry Reid is giving up after 30 years. John Ralston is the editor and publisher of The Ralston Report and an expert on politics in the Silver State. John, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Hi, Ken.
So we have set up the race for us. We know that Harry Reid is leaving. Who's the Democrat? Who's the Republican trying to succeed him?
Catherine Cortez Masto is the former attorney general, a Democrat, who was running to succeed Harry Reid. She would be the first Latina ever elected to the U.S. Senate. She was out of office for 2 years before jumping into this race on the same day that Harry Reid announced his retirement. It was very well choreographed. She's running against Joe Heck, who's in his third term in Congress in a district that is all in southern Nevada, where Las Vegas is. He's a brigadier general, Iraq veteran. He's got a great profile. He essentially was the second choice of Republicans nationally who wanted Brian Sandoval, the governor, to run. But Heck is a first-class candidate, and this race has been a toss-up the whole way.
Now, Harry Reid is leaving the Senate, but his presence is huge in this race, isn't it?
It really is. In fact, he has been used by Joe Heck's campaign from the word go in a lot of advertising and rhetoric, saying that he has handpicked his successor. Catherine Cortez Masto is his puppet. There's a new add-on that just started in Nevada that morphs Harry Reid's face into Catherine Cortez Masto's face, very subtle indeed. And so they are running against Harry Reid as much as they're running against her.
Harry Reid has failed Nevada for 30 years. Now he's picked his successor. But Catherine Cortez Masto has failed Nevada too.
And there's also, I mean, we've been talking about this for many cycles, but especially this year, the Latino vote could be very consequential for Cortez Masto, couldn't it?
It could be, and undoubtedly will be very, very important, as it has been the last two presidential cycles and races up and down the ballot. It was 15% of the electorate in 2008 and 18% in 2012. Democrats are optimistic they can get it up to a fifth of the electorate or more this time, which would help not just Cortez Masto, but Hillary Clinton and Democrats up and down the ballot. It looks anecdotally like that could happen based on some of the early voting numbers that are out. But Cortez Masto, in a lot of polling, despite being the first Latina who could be ever elected to the U.S. Senate, has run significantly behind Hillary Clinton among Latinos. One of the reasons for that is that she just was, even though she was a two-term statewide elected official, she was not that well known. She didn't do a lot to promote herself. So she's had to reintroduce or even introduce herself to voters, which took up a lot of time and money.
From what I've seen in the polls, Donald Trump is doing well in Nevada. He's running strongly. But when Joe Heck said he was unendorsing Donald Trump or distancing himself from him, I mean, I guess the question I'm asking is Heck getting hell from the Trump voters after that move?
Well, he's certainly getting some heck or hell from them, yes. He was booed at the rally in which he announced that not only was he unendorsing Trump, but he wanted him to get off the ticket. There were scattered, maybe significant boos. The whole crowd didn't boo, but he is getting destroyed on right-wing talk radio in Nevada for that. He is also being hit now by the Democrats for now not saying who he would vote for in the election. It's a very, very difficult needle to thread, obviously, Ken, to stay with Trump all this time and then suddenly do the Claude Rains in Casablanca after you see the Access Hollywood video. No idea, shock, that Donald Trump was that kind of person. I must unendorse him now. And so he's getting a lot of blowback on that, and I think he's going to lose votes over it, enough to cost him the race, maybe.
I was going to say that you have people like Rob Portman in Ohio, who clearly kept his distance but ran a very strong campaign. I wonder, for Joe Heck to have this break from Trump so late in the campaign, it just may have, I mean, I guess the question is who wins and how seriously did Heck hurt his chances by breaking with Trump?
Yeah, I mean, that remains to be seen, of course. The early voting numbers look very ominous for him, but after 4 days out of 14. But I have to say, he has run, in many ways, a very, very good campaign, as has all the outside groups. There's going to be more outside spending in this race, Ken, than in the history of Nevada Senate races. It may end up being a $100 million race, which is huge for Nevada, and most of it from outside spending, and in defining Catherine Cortez Masto as a corrupt attorney general. And as I mentioned, since people didn't have a very good definition of her, the definition by the Heck campaign and the outside forces, I think, has been fairly effective. And so her negatives have gone up a lot. So he has a chance to hold on, I think, and take the seat. The analogy that might be apt is in 2012, when Obama won the state by almost 7 points, but Dean Heller, the appointed U.S. senator running for election, won his race by 12,000 votes against the tide. Heck is hoping to repeat what was really a spectacular feat back then.
You've never had a state that had a Heller and a Heck in the same Senate delegation, did they?
That's right.
John, if you had to predict, what would you say?
I think the state at the top of the ticket now is leaning very much toward both Democratic candidates. And listen, we'll know more at the end of early voting. 62% or so will vote early. We'll know a lot by the end of that. There's going to have to be some real anomalies, though, for this not to be a very strong Democratic year in Nevada.
John Ralston is the editor and publisher of The Ralston Report. You can find him on Twitter at Ralston Reports. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we shift to Missouri, which for the longest time seemed like a sure victory for the Republican incumbent, Rory Blunt. That may no longer be the case. Steve Kraske is a political columnist for the Kansas City Star and the host of Up to Date, which is heard on radio station KCUR. Steve, it's great to have you back on the show.
Ken, glad to be here.
So we're talking about the Missouri Senate race, and that's one race I didn't think we'd be talking about.
Boy, no kidding. This race seemed to come out of nowhere just a couple of months ago. It was way down everybody's list of most competitive Senate races in the country. Today, Ken, I think it's right at the top of the list, maybe due at least in large part to a TV ad he put up that shows him blindfolded assembling a military gun.
Well, before you say he, tell us who the candidates are. Get us up to speed on who's running.
Yeah, it's Democrat Jason Kander. He's the Secretary of State here in Missouri. He's a former state lawmaker from Kansas City. He's the Democrat. The Republican is an incumbent. His name is Roy Blunt. He's a first-term incumbent, but he also had a very long career in the U.S. House of Representatives. He, too, is a former Missouri Secretary of State.
And tell me, what brought Kander up into people's consciousness?
Well, you know, I think a couple of factors are at work here, Ken. One is the campaign that Jason Kander has run, which has included this now famous TV ad in Missouri, which very well could be the most notable TV campaign ad of the entire 2016 cycle, whether it's in Missouri or across the country. This ad really put Jason Kander on the map. It diffused the gun issue for a Democrat in a tough swing state like Missouri and garnered him all kinds of attention. This is a TV ad, a 30-second TV ad, where Jason Kander is standing in a warehouse, Ken. He's blindfolded, and he's assembling a military rifle from scratch.
I'm Jason Kander, and Senator Blunt has been attacking me on guns. Well, in the Army, I learned how to use and respect my rifle. In Afghanistan, I'd volunteer to be an extra gun in a convoy of unarmored SUVs. And in the state legislature, I supported Second Amendment rights. I also believe in background checks so that terrorists can't get their hands on one of these. I approve this message because I'd like to see Senator Blunt do this.
It seems like the Democrats always have this ambivalent issue of guns and races across the country. But in a pro-gun state like Missouri, Kander seemed to parry it very effectively.
Boy, this is the way to directly challenge that kind of thinking, Ken, by showing a former military veteran like Jason Kander handling a gun like this. It really takes the wind out of the sails of folks who say that Democrats are against gun rights. Jason Kander showing that he's very much not in that camp. What's interesting about the ad and what's been lost really in the conversation is Jason in the ad speaks out on behalf of background checks on guns, and that's an issue, of course, the NRA has a huge problem with. But Kander is speaking on behalf of background checks in the ad. That's gotten lost here because what he does blindfolded is pretty impressive, and that's what got so much attention out here. But at a time and in a cycle when guns are really the new abortion issue across the country, where you stand has proven to be a dividing line between Republicans and Democrats and liberal and conservative. You know, Jason Kander, I think, really threw some water on that fire by releasing this ad, and it just ended any criticism of him when it comes to where he stands on guns.
Well, obviously, Senator Blunt felt the ad was effective because he responded with his own ad.
Some people can put together a gun blindfolded. Some do it really fast. Some really, really fast. Some do it upside down and blindfolded. But only one of these is a Hillary Clinton national campaign chairman. Only one received an F for his failure to defend the Second Amendment. Only one supports amnesty for illegal immigrants. When it comes to the U.S. Senate, Missouri voters know what's important.
I'm Roy Blunt, and I approve this message.
Steve, we're in a state where Donald Trump is pretty popular, or at least he's expected to win pretty handily, one of the states where Republicans are not running away from Donald Trump. But what's the dynamic between Blunt and Kander right now?
You know, the dynamic simply is the race has moved into this very competitive category. And, you know, what's interesting, Ken, is you don't see either candidate, Republican or Democrat, criticizing or praising Donald Trump. He's really a non-issue, and that's for an important reason. I think Jason Kander, again, the Democrat, is aware of the fact that Trump's popular in Missouri. He wants to win over some of those voters to his side, so he hasn't been very critical of Donald Trump. Now, Roy Blunt, the Republican incumbent, has been straddling this line. You know, a third of his party detests Donald Trump and wants to see him repudiate Trump and unendorse him. he's got probably the majority of the Republican Party in Missouri still standing behind the Republican presidential nominee, and Blunt is hard-pressed to disown Donald Trump with that kind of climate in the state. So Blunt's been forced to straddle this line between the pro-Trump and the anti-Trump factions within his own state, and it's proven to be really a difficult tight wire to walk, as it's been for so many Republican candidates across the country.
And I noticed in the Blunt campaign ad, he ties Kander to Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton is not, shall we say, popular in Missouri.
No, she's not, and she's not even competing here at all, Ken, as you well know. Although the race has tightened here, you know, 6-7 weeks ago, the thinking was Trump was ahead by 8, 9, 10, maybe 11 points in Missouri. The thinking now is it's down to 2, 3, 4, 5, somewhere in that range. So that decline has come at the same time that the Senate race has tightened, and speaks to the fact, the difficulty that Roy Blunt has had trying to navigate and satisfy both these factions within his own party.
Blunt hasn't done anything particularly, you know, insidious that would cause his supporters to desert him, has he?
No. I mean, he's been a very much of a steady Eddie kind of lawmaker, Ken. He's done all the right things. He's visited all the counties. He's available. He talks to reporters. He's been a regular presence in the state. He's more or less the titular head of the Republican Party now in Missouri, because the Democrats control the governor's office and, you know, that kind of thing. So, no, he's been solid. I think the black mark against Senator Blunt, at least as it's portrayed in TV ads that are run against him, both this cycle and in past cycles, is his family, which is comprised of lobbyists now. He has a daughter and two sons, all of whom do lobbying work. He married a lobbyist out in Washington, and he got caught more than a decade ago trying to insert a provision that would have been helpful to his wife in a Homeland Security bill. He got caught, and he had to remove the provision as the bill progressed down the road. That was an embarrassment for him, and it certainly provided his enemies an opening to go after a senator who is so closely tied to lobbyists inside his own family.
Who wins?
Boy, I think very much of a toss-up race. It feels that way. The Democrats think they've got this thing, Ken. They think they're going to win even by 2-3 points going away here on Election Day. We'll see. Roy Blunt's been around Missouri for decades now, and, again, has been a steady Eddie kind of presence inside the Republican Party, has found a way to navigate between the moderate and the more conservative factions. But is this the right year for a long-time politician who's been around for a long time? This cycle, as you've talked about so many times, has really put a premium on fresh faces, new people, new ideas. And that may speak to the fact that it just may well turn out to be Jason Kander's time.
Steve Kraske is a political columnist for the Kansas City Star, and he's host on radio station KCUR. He's on Twitter at Steve Kraske, K-R-A-S-K-E. Steve, it's great having you on the program.
Ken, always happy to do it.
And we have a new Political Junkie contest for you to enter. Send your predictions on who will win the top 10 Senate races of 2016. The winner will get a Political Junkie t-shirt. And the deadline to enter is Tuesday, November 1st. For more information, go to our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Oh, good morning, Missouri, and how have you been? I've been all night just to see you again. And the thunder behind me and plenty of wind. The mountains ahead where I'm going. This ragged old car says hello to you too. Many a mile since when first we were through. Just a couple of drifters with nothing to do. We'll go where the wind was blowing. The cornfields lie waiting for the sweet summer sun to bring back the life winter took on the run. And it's westbound through small towns with a song to be sung. Child on the open road.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last vice president who challenged his boss in the next election? The answer? John Nance Garner. Garner, known as Cactus Jack, was a two-term vice president under Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1930s. When FDR decided to seek a third term in 1940, Garner challenged him at the convention, but failed to win the nomination. And the winner is Jeffrey Goldwasser of East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Jeffrey wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more, on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Cactus man, what do you do? And your soul is on fire, well, it's very soon. Cactus man, what do you do? When the
ordinarily, we would be presenting our This Week in Political History feature at this time in the program. But we're changing that for this episode. Tom Hayden died this week. Best remembered for his protest during the 1968 Democratic Convention, Hayden was on our program last year, talking about his role in the infamous Chicago 7 trial of 1969. Before we hear from Tom, just a quick flashback. The war was waging in Vietnam, and the Democrats were set to nominate Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who was part of the administration waging the war. Chicago, which was hosting the Democratic convention, was tense. Here was Chet Huntley of NBC News.
There have been some demonstrations at this early hour in downtown Chicago's Grant Park. We heard a moment ago that tear gas has been used. As the demonstrators are attempting to form a line of parade and march toward or on the amphitheater.
A riot ensued in the streets of Chicago. Hundreds of demonstrators and not a few cops were hurt. The following year, a federal grand jury indicted those it felt to be responsible for the mayhem. Among those was Tom Hayden. Here was my conversation with him last year. Tom Hayden, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hello, Mr. Junkie. How are you?
Okay. I'm so happy you're on the show. Give us a sense what things were like by the time of summer of 1968. The Vietnam War was going on in full force. Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy were murdered. The world just didn't seem right.
Well, yeah, the Chicago trial was kind of a morality play, a stage on which all those forces were personified, and it was on television every night, and it was a time when people were really glued to it, as if it could explain what had happened in the 60s. I might add, before we go further, that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals threw out those convictions.
Right, November of 1972, like 2 years later, right.
And found the judge and the prosecution to be in misconduct. So that's why we didn't go to prison for 5 years. We were in Cook County Jail for 3 weeks pending bail. Everybody in Cook County Jail, by the way, was there because they couldn't afford bail, and so they were being essentially jailed before they had been tried or convicted of anything.
When I talk about this Chicago 7, I wonder if people, young people today, have any idea what I'm talking about.
No, they have no idea.
So tell me about David Dellinger and Rennie Davis and Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. I mean, they're part of my youth, but tell me who they were and who you were.
Well, let's start with the eighth, Bobby Seale, the chairman of the Black Panther Party. In those days, the symbol of black militancy around the country. He was only marginally related to the events in Chicago. He gave a very militant speech, and that was it. That earned him an indictment. But the reason I bring him up is that during the trial, he insisted that he had a right under the Constitution to represent himself, which is something that African-Americans won after the Civil War and Reconstruction. And every time he tried to say something in court, he was shut down by the judge until sometime in the middle of the trial, The judge actually ordered him to be chained and gagged, taken into another room, his mouth taped, his wrists chained to a chair, and carried back into the room by the marshals. That was a spectacle that went around the world for several days. The reason I mention that is that when that is depicted in television documentaries or films, quite often young people, students of today, take that as fictional license, that we made that up just to dramatize the point that black people can't get justice in an American courtroom or something like that. And when we say, no, this actually happened, this is a literal rendition of what happened, they have an extremely hard time believing it. That's how rapidly consciousness can be driven into forgetting or denial, or even something that's well covered in the media is gone within a couple of decades.
Well, it sounds like everything Judge Hoffman did hurt his case. Not only the Bobby Seale, the binding and gagging of Bobby Seale, but I mean everything, the way he handled the trial seemed to fall into your lap as just, you know, just a gift.
Well, we weren't looking for that gift. It's very difficult to get up at 5 in the morning in a freezing Chicago winter and go to court knowing that you'll get a contempt citation if you're 5 minutes late, and then spend all day and then spend the night interviewing the next day's witnesses and so on. He did, for whatever reason, repeatedly commit egregious forms of misconduct, arbitrary rulings, and so on. And that's why the case was thrown out.
Just to go back to a little bit, before the grand jury convened, what was the original plan for Chicago and the convention? You weren't going to stop Humphrey. You weren't going to end the war. What was the goal?
Well, it had been a very frustrating time, painfully so, as you mentioned. The candidate who I leaned toward, Robert Kennedy, had been murdered. The leader of the civil rights movement, Dr. King, had been murdered. There were two of several murders in the 60s that really made progressive social change impossible, at least within the system. And the war was raging. And so we had the idea that we had to somehow awaken the peace movement and the rank-and-file Democratic members of the Democratic Party to the need for an anti-war platform and, if necessary, a new candidate. Some people in our coalition on the conservative side of it were big proponents of Eugene McCarthy, senator from Minnesota. Young people marched in the snow of New Hampshire and helped him almost upset President Johnson on an anti-war platform. Other people favored an attempt to get 100,000. That was considered a large number in those days. 100,000 people to encircle the convention arena or flood downtown with protests in the belief that the delegates would hear us and they would vote for a peace platform and rebuke President Johnson. We never got permits for any of our marches, and therefore the large demonstrations never happened. And you started to get bedlam in the streets because people tried to march anyway, but they had no permits, and police would chase them down and beat them and gas them and drag us away to Cook County Jail. So it was a situation where we thought the question was, how important was this war to the Democrats winning the election? It seemed to us they had to choose. If they wanted to elect Humphrey, if they wanted to elect a Democrat, it was clear that the policy had to change. And it was the refusal to change the policy, but instead to crush the demonstrators in the streets that kind of foretold the outcome in which Vice President Humphrey lost by, I think, a fraction of 1% to Nixon in November, and the rest was history.
I think of those two separate events. I think of the violence and the horror and the mayhem on the streets of Chicago, and then I think of the trial itself, which I can't imagine it being fun, but it just seemed like a Woody Allen movie. Actually, there's a scene in a Woody Allen movie in Bananas where he's on trial for treason or something, and the judge has him bound and gagged, and he's actually interrogating a witness with tape over his mouth. And I always thought of your trial.
Oh, that might have been our trial. I don't know what year that was.
70.
Yeah, that would have been us.
Yeah. This is 45 years ago. Was it fun? Were you angry?
No. There were some defendants like Abby Hoffman who really had a very original, carnivalesque approach to the courtroom, knowing that the image on the media would be more important in the news than any mere words or legal arguments. And so there were persistent attempts along those lines. For example, he and Jerry Rubin one day came to court wearing robes. They had gotten judicial robes, black robes, that they wore into court, sat down, and the judge went crazy and asked what they were doing and ordered that they strip off those robes, the robes of the judiciary. And so they pulled off the robes, and under the robes were Chicago Police Department shirts. And they were trying to illustrate the idea that we thought that the courtroom was another form of the Chicago police repressive machinery, that it was not an independent judiciary. And I think that's why the trial has always been fodder for comedians and for dramatists and seen as being comic. But you have to remember that two members of the Black Panther Party were murdered in their beds by Chicago police on an early November morning when they were supposed to join us in the courtroom, and Bobby Seale was chained and gagged. So depending on how you look at it, it had an extremely negative and forbidding quality to it, mixed in with the humorous elements.
Years later, you ran for the Senate against a Democratic incumbent and got more than 1 million votes in the primary. You served in the state legislature for nearly 20 years. Can you be a radical? And I don't even know what that means. But can you be a radical? Can you battle the establishment from within? Can you make a difference that way?
Yes, I think you can. It's not easy, but it's not easy in the streets either. Take, for example, you know, possible presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont. He's from my generation, and he worked his way through local government in Vermont. He's got a popular touch. It's a small state. You don't have to have money to buy television ads every 30 seconds. And he's formidable, and I think he is trying to battle the powers that be, defined as you know, corporations and banks who dominate our campaign spending. And as I recall, he comes out of the anti-Vietnam movement many years ago. There's also John Lewis, who was beaten up at Selma and was a good friend of mine and was an early chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he served many decades honorably in the House. But these examples are rare. I admit that. There are not many of us who chose a political path. It takes a whole different mentality, I suppose. But yes, I think if you have good instinct for people and a good instinct on issues, that you can do a great deal within the system. Acting as an agent of social movements on the inside, of course, not abandoning them.
What are you doing now? What are you working on now?
I spend a lot of time in California on the climate change issue with Governor Brown and some legislators, and the anti-fracking movement is quite strong here. We're trying to turn California into the number one model of greenhouse gas reductions and do it through jobs and environmental justice. That's number one, and that's for the next several years, I hope. But I've also spent a lot of time trying to oppose involvement in what I consider to be religious sectarian wars in the Middle East, where no matter what we do, we don't seem to have good outcomes. A lot of people get killed. Billions, even trillions of dollars in the long run are spent on unwinnable wars. I see all that energy, all that money that could be spent on housing or environmental restoration. Those are the two. And I do a lot of writing for the Nation magazine and my own website, which is democracyjournaltomhayden.com.
Tom Hayden is a veteran political activist, part of the Chicago Seven, that took part in the demonstrations outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968. He also served in the California State Legislature and serves on the board of the Progressive Democrats of America. Tom Hayden, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken. Anytime. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
That was my conversation in February of 2015 with Tom Hayden. He died this week at the age of 76.
So your brother's bound and gagged, and they've chained him to a chair. Won't you please come to Chicago just to sing? In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring?
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. We can change.